The Sports Career Podcast, episode 363, How to Create Change in the Football Industry. Hello, Sports Achiever, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Sports Career Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bowers. As always, my goal each week is to provide you a special guest who's an expert in a particular sector in the sports industry. Especially if you have an interest in pursuing a career in the football industry, I hope today's episode can support your sports career development, interests, and needs. Now, getting back to today's podcast special guest is Lawrence Jones. Lawrence has over 30 plus years in the football industry, with over 10 years at the FA, where his current role is head of the National League system at the FA. For that reason, it's such a privilege to have Lawrence as a podcast special guest on the show, where he will share his football career journey and explain to you how to create change in the football industry. So grab a pen, get your paper, take some notes, and enjoy. Lawrence, it's such a joy to have you on the podcast show. Please, you share to your listeners your football career journey. When did it all start?
My first ever game of football I went to was back in 1967 when my dad took me to watch what was then Bournemouth and Boscombe Athletic Football Club, longest name in the Football League at that time, play Brighton and Hove Albion. So that filled the front page of the programme, just the two title names of the club. And I guess, like any 6-7-year-old kid, I was starry-eyed by the atmosphere and the environment, and I guess a lifelong love affair with football started at that point, if I'm honest with you, Ed. It's football was in a very different world in those days, wasn't it? Smoke-filled stadiums and predominantly...
Terraces, I assume?
Tendencies were, I think Bournemouth probably had about 10,000 that day from that's the sort of crowds they were putting in the old Dean Court. And it was predominantly male audience, if I'm honest. That was the start of point, I suppose, with a lifelong love affair with football that's taken me in many different directions. And there's actually no doubt that, yeah, I think everyone has a golden thread in their journey in life, and football has been my golden thread.
Just with regards to that golden thread then, could you paint the picture from an industry standpoint? Because for me, I know a little bit of it, meeting you last year at the BL Bulls event of your career path. But could you just share to listeners the career path, particularly your refereeing, which I'm fascinated to where you are now?
Well, I suppose having been a football fan from the age of six, I reached the tender age of 19, 20, and probably like most football fans, have been less than complimentary at times about refereeing decisions. And a very good friend of mine, John Harris, was the groundsman at AFC Bournemouth at the time. And John said to me, he said, Lawrence, stop moaning about referees. If you think you do a better job, go and be a referee. And being a sort of, you know, petulant 19-year-old, I said, OK, I will. If ever I've made one decision in my life that was a life-changing decision, it was becoming a referee. Never did I, when I sort of qualified from learning the laws of the game in the front room of a chap called Clifford Platt in Bournemouth, who taught me. And my first game on a local parks pitch in Bournemouth that took me on a career that I never dreamed possible. And I ended up running the line on the Football League and being at places like Stamford Bridge and large grounds like that. It was fantastic. Best time of my life. But what refereeing really taught me was so many different life skills, you know, from how to present myself, make sure how to deal with administration in a correct and proper way, how to manage people, manage conflict, not be afraid to make the difficult decisions that we all have to make in life. And it's really set the standard, and it opened the door to me to actually start working in the game in 2000. I had a 25-year career as a referee, and had many voluntary roles. And I think I'd say to anybody who wants to ultimately work in the game, the best way to understand the game is to get beneath the surface and start and do some voluntary work in the game. Understand how a football club runs. Understand what needs to be a coach. Understand what needs to be a referee and all the support mechanisms, because we all have a great view of the end product out on the green stuff on a Saturday. But it's a bit like an iceberg. That end product actually is probably only about 10% of what happens beneath the surface, because football doesn't just happen. And, we're incredibly privileged in this country to have a football structure across from the very top to the very bottom of the game, which is very well structured, And sometimes people can complain that perhaps it's a bit bureaucratic, it's a bit dated, but the reality is that structure creates a sustainable football environment in England, and that is really key. So anybody who wants to, and the world has changed dramatically because there are so many different career opportunities, both directly in and attached to football. But I think, like anything in life, you need to understand the environment. You need to understand the industry. And my refereeing career gave me that grounding, if I'm very honest with you. And so not only did it help me develop as a person, because listen, I was the fat kid who left school with nothing, basically. I wasn't academically gifted. I went to a boys-only school in Dorset. It was pretty. It wasn't a bad school, and the teachers actually, with what they had available to them, was pretty remarkable what the outputs were. But I wasn't academically gifted. Football was my life. From the moment I first watched my first match at Bournemouth, I was only interested in football, I'll be very honest with you. And I wasn't very good at playing the game. The height of my playing ability was Division 10 of the Bournemouth Sunday League, although I was quite a prolific goal scorer at that level, but never got picked up. And so refereeing taught me things that perhaps I couldn't learn in an academic world.
Can we touch on that from those? You talked about standards and difficult decisions as a referee, but I want to go back to your standards point of being a ref as an individual, as a person. Reflecting now, how did it make you grounded from a value standpoint? Like you said, when that person said, well, if you want to be a referee, do it yourself. Like reflecting on just that one point right now, how has that helped you in the standards of working the game from an administration standpoint at the FA?
I think it taught me various skills, I guess. Football's about people. And so relationships, listening, and understanding other people's point of view. But also not being afraid to make the really tough calls and to make those calls and not to try it. You should never be afraid to try and find solutions. I think that's always important. There's always trying to find solutions, but don't break the rules, because it will always come back and bite you. Always come back and bite.
So how do we find the balance of innovation and change to then not breaking the rules? Big question, I know, but I'm just curious from a process standpoint of what you've just said there.
Well, I think the solution is that you find the solution within the framework that is available to you. Yeah. And if the rules aren't right, don't be afraid to change the rules. But football is a regulated sport, and rightly so. And the regulations are set. But we shouldn't be a slave to those regulations if the regulations were set in a period that is now different to the world that we live in. So we have to learn to be agile. We have to accept
Yes,
change.
100%.
The world changes, and if sport, and in this case football, doesn't change, it gets left behind.
I'm going to say another big question then. Sorry to interrupt, but I think this is key. You said right at the beginning you started watching football with your father. It was very male. When did the change happen with regards to women football, relating to your experience? Because for me, not just the Euros, but we've got somebody in common with Rachel Pavlou who's been in the game for 20 years. And it's probably been 25 years to see the all hard work, seeing the end product on the pitch with the 2020 Euros from a success standpoint. So I'm just curious, from your lens, how have you seen change from a simple standpoint of women's football as an example?
It's an interesting question because I think, and there's no one straight answer to that question, to be honest, because it depends how you play. If you look in terms of female participation playing the game, the change has been driven dramatically, I think, since 2000. 2000 was when it really started to happen, very slowly. Trailblazers like Kelly Simmons, Rachel Pavlo, you know, Lucy Wellings, people who are key, who have really driven the game. But that was a tough period because they were up against a lot of traditional views, and in a what was a male dominated environment, if we're honest about it. The creation of the Women's Professional League has really driven the game and raised standards. And I think certainly over, certain, I mean, it's easy to pinpoint the Euros, and the Euros is definitely one of the high points because the growth has been quite spectacular since then. If you look at it from an angle of football being a more open and inclusive environment in terms of spectators, I think we have to remember football stadia back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, dare I say 90s, there were some pretty grim old places to go and watch football. They weren't customer friendly. If you think how football used to be and the environment that the professional game and even other aspects of the game were played in, I can remember some of the grounds I went to back in the 70s. You know, they were grim old places, let's be honest about it. So the investment in stadia stock in this country through the Football Foundation, through the Premier League Stadia Fund, has dramatically changed that landscape. If you look at the stadia stock in this country today, both in the professional game, the Premier League and the EFL, and in the National League system, the area of the game I look after, the stadia stock is significantly, there's no comparison to how the grounds used to be. That then makes the environment, a different environment to attract different social groups of people to the game. And the mindset is changing. The mindset's changing in the game. The game, we want the game to be totally inclusive. We want everyone to come and watch football. We want it to be fan friendly. You know, make it, if you present a positive, enjoyable environment to watch a sport in any event, really, but we'll focus on football, people will come back. If it's somewhere where they go where they don't have a good time and it's not a very nice environment and they hear unacceptable things they don't want to hear that isn't acceptable in the game, and it's not a warm and welcoming environment, people say, well, actually, I'm not going to do that again. I'll go and do something else.
To be fair, there's no difference between what you've just said then in a bad working environment.
No, it's not. Football is our workplace, isn't it? So you want it to be a positive environment. And all of us who are involved in the game, we all want it to be a positive environment. You know? And it's something we all own as the game as well. We all own that. We all own the responsibility to make football open, accessible, and a positive experience, whatever that experience is for that individual, whether it be a player, a referee, a coach, a fan, an administrator, a volunteer, whatever, we have a responsibility. And what is absolutely paramount to that is facilities. If you've got a really, people's behaviour is often reflected by the facility environment they are in. If you look at the makeup of football today, it's significantly different than it was when I started my journey. You know, I think football is absolutely open and accessible. You know, I don't think we necessarily have got it all right, but I think football is in a far better place today than certainly even 20 years ago it was.
Just to put things in perspective, because we are talking about England or the UK with regards to, like, we're not talking worldwide. And I did say this question to Rachel Pavlou in Athens of, because she's so proud to wear the Football for All badge. She said, out of all the badges, that's the one. May I ask, what's your definition of Football for All? And with that slogan and logo as well, how powerful it is, relating to what you've just said now, it is, you know, it's a football is for all from an inclusivity standpoint. But I'll just love your definition, reflecting from your experience in the game as well.
Well, when I started working in the game, there was a slogan that Adam Crozier through the FA pulled out, which was news in football to build a better future, or something to that effect. And that really resonated to me, really resonated as to the absolute power of this sport. And Football for All, I think, is a shorter derivative of that for me. There should be absolutely no barriers to anybody who wants to be involved in football. Doesn't matter what the role is in football. And Football for All I think the words are really simple. It is for all. What sits beneath that is a responsibility for those of us who lead the game in whatever capacity to make sure the environment is right for all. And that's everybody involved in the game in whatever capacity has a responsibility to that. If Football for All is true to its word, and I absolutely am with Rachel on this, it is the most important statement there is. Football is for everybody. After a lifetime in the game, I am so passionate about the value of what this global phenomenon can do for people and for the society we live in. We should embrace it with both arms all the time and really drive it through. It was really interesting during COVID, talking to parents of children when we reopened after COVID at the club I'm involved in, and how and number of people said to me how they missed the club, how their kids missed their football experience. And it was, I think it was those words that so resonated the importance a football club has in its community. We always focus on what happens on the green stuff, but actually that's only a fraction of the impact a football club has on people and the community in which it serves.
Do we think we forget that now in today's modern game, particularly in the men's game, the community factor? Big question, I know, but I think it's the lifeblood, in my opinion, of a successful club.
I don't think we do forget it, actually. I think there is a greater acceptance now of the role football clubs have in their community. You know, I think it's, listen, I first got involved with my professional club, Bournemouth, back in the late end of the 60s, early 70s. One of the roles I did there with a group of friends of mine, we formed one of the very first ever junior supporters clubs for a football league club. And it was in the back room at the back of the stand and didn't have very much. But it worked, you know, and it created a community environment. And back in those days, football was pretty matter of fact, to be honest with you. It was, you know, you play a game on a Saturday and you play it midweek and players train and fans came and watched. There wasn't much else happening around the football club. If you look at the game to the day and the impact that the game has, both at Premier League level, Football League level, and at National League system level, and our grassroots clubs, and we have some phenomenal grassroots clubs in football, they play such an important role in their local community and in people's lives. You know? And so I think the game is progressing in the right way. And, you know, it's very, very much part of the FA agenda going forward to really drive the community role of clubs and what we deliver in supporting our society.
Just one thing I want to factor from a club standpoint, because I think I really love the work you're doing in the National League, and I want to bring it in because, like you said, a lot of the time we see the end product. How important is it to look at and have focus on the grassroots level, just from a mass participation standpoint in general, but also new talent, that they do have those pathways to be professional players? I'm curious from your experience, do you think now with these academies, it's a very, very effective system now from a grassroots standpoint?
Without any shadow of doubt, the game is in a better place today at grassroots than it's ever been. If I look at, I've had the privilege of working in the game since 2000 when I became chief executive of the Hampshire FA. And if I look at what's been achieved in the last 23, 24 years of, you know, we've accredited clubs through Charter Standard and now the FA Accreditation Club Programme and League Programme, with our safeguarding and welfare standards that have been introduced and driven through that period. Again, with the quality of facilities and the different variations of the game that encourage player development. With all youth sides now having to have a qualified coach. When I ran my first youth team back in 1978 as an unqualified coach, there was no safeguarding standards in place. We were under 13s playing on a full size adult pitch with big goals, with no changing rooms. And I now look at the grassroots game today and the investment that's been made both in terms of structure, facilities, accreditations, qualifications. I think the product that is now out there being delivered by incredible volunteers. I mean, the volunteer community of football in this country is phenomenal. It's truly outstanding. And I think sometimes we forget how good it really is. And I guess if you don't know how it used to be when I started my journey, and you look at how it is today, perhaps it's difficult to make that judgment call. But as someone who spent his life in football, I look at the offer children have in football today and it's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And I don't actually think we celebrate it enough. And what's really exciting, you know, is seeing these young children come through now and playing in, you know, under qualified coaches in a safe environment, in decent facilities. With all sorts of nationalities, boys and girls, you know, and the diversity and the growth of the game, certainly at youth level, is something we should be really proud of in this country. And the FA, through its and its county FAs and its leagues, should be really, really proud of what the offer is. It will never be perfect because football is just such a huge sport in this country, you know. But if you take a helicopter view of where we are today, compared with when I started my journey with the first youth team I ran back in the late 70s, it's just different worlds.
Yeah, I bet. But just one that I want to touch on even more now, because I'm really enjoying this conversation. You said about investment of the safe environment. How important is leadership to make these milestone changes over that period of time, meaning effective leadership from the bottom all the way up to the top? I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that side of things.
To drive change and to you need many skills. Leadership is one of them. Leadership, having a clear vision, having drive, having energy, having determination, not being afraid to say when you've made a mistake or got it wrong, not being afraid to change direction if your original plan doesn't quite fulfill what you want to achieve, but do it in a way that galvanizes people around you. I think collaboration is really important. I think it's very easy for leaders to be criticized, but actually you sometimes have to take a step back and see what the big picture is rather than the specific actions are sometimes. It's having a clear vision of what you want your outcome to be. And I think football is very good at this, sometimes you can't go A to B. Sometimes you have to go out to Z before you get to B. But it's really important not to lose sight of what your long-term vision is. You know, and you can't always achieve your vision perhaps within the timescales you want. you sometimes have to say, I'd like to do it in 12 months, but it might take 36 months or it might take 60 months.
I'm going to put you on the spot again because it, with the vision standpoint, relating to your experience, what vision have you seen? It could be Football for All, by the way, because we have talked about that type of case study. But just when you say a vision, what vision have you seen successful over a time period relating to your career? I know it's a big question, but just to put some clarity, just a bit of clarity to that word vision.
I'm going to use a non-FA example. I'm going to use my involvement at the club I'm involved with. I was asked by my partner to come and look at Harbour Town Football Club about 10 years ago. Nice football club, nice people, but the football club was in all sorts of difficulties for a whole row of various reasons. And it's funny, when I first drove into the site, I looked at the site and I thought, my God, what a natural environment for a football hub. And so I jumped in the deep end of the swimming pool, probably upset a lot of people, if I'm honest, because I was driving change, and had to, and I had to get a group of people around me who had the same vision. So I had to bring in new faces and galvanize people. And I did that in a very open and transparent way. And I had to lose a few people on the way, being honest about it, because that's what change is about, unfortunately. And at that point, the club was in both operational and financial distress, if I'm truthful. And it was, I suppose, 10 years on, 11 years on, perhaps, thinking about it, we're at a stage now where we've changed from being a facility that had 48 separate teams into a football club with 63 teams. We've got 1,000 children registered. We've got a first team playing at the highest level in its history. We've seen our first team attendances increase from 50 to averaging around 300. We are a debt-free football club. We are now an employer in the town. We have 5 full-time employees and 19 casual staff. We have strategic partnerships with all the big players in our community, and we probably touch 35%, 40% of the town's population in one way or another. And the club is now in a really strong place, which has enabled me to step back a little bit and let the new generations move it forward. And how did I go about that? Determination, driven, passionate, used learnings from my journey. Used learnings from being a chief executive of a bankrupt pro club and the challenges that brought. Used my, I guess I used my people skills that I've learned over, the last 5 decades and what have you. And it's about creating a. If you want to deliver a vision, you've got to create a collective ownership and an excitement. And you're only going to do that if you take people with you. You haven't got to agree with everybody all the time, and you haven't got to be afraid of making tough calls. Because if you're going to drive change and you're driving change for positive outcomes, you are going to make some tough calls. And you can't duck those decisions. However unpleasant they are, you still have to make them. Otherwise, you won't achieve what your goal is. But you can do it in such a way that you take people with you.
Just by talking about the tough calls, how has it made you stronger with your character now from those learning lessons?
I've no, I think, listen, if you had to go into a changing room in a professional football club on a Friday before a match day and tell, a group of professional footballers are not being played, but they got to play football the following day, there aren't many tougher calls than that. And, if you've been pulled from your bed in the middle of the night, because there's a group of minders who want to change the locks on the stadium, because the club hasn't paid its rent. There aren't many tough calls, it's and what it's and the thing it's taught me is never shirk a difficult decision. Be honest. You can deliver it in a very nice way. You can deliver it however you need to deliver it, but don't duck the difficult decisions, because if you duck them, they are going to come back to you. You're not going to get rid of them. If you've got a difficult decision to make, it's happened because of a reason. So unless you solve the reason, you're not going to solve the difficult decision. And so as a person, don't be afraid to make difficult decisions, but do it in the way that you'd like to receive it as a person.
Got you. So how what's your approach on that? Is it like, 'cause my next theme was about the importance of integrity. So how important is integrity in the mix of making a hard decision then, of how you deliver it?
Crucial. Crucial. I think integrity, I think honesty, transparency, empathy are all the disciplines you need if you're going to be a leader. Great believer in that. Integrity is really important. If you haven't got integrity, then at some point you will fail as a leader.
What's your definition of integrity, particularly in football?
Openness, honesty, transparency, consistency. Don't break the rules.
Look, I hope people are taking notes and enjoying this conversation. I do want to go back in time a little bit because you said you've done 20 plus years as a referee. I just want the listeners to learn, was there a period when you pivoted to go, no, I want to work for the FA? Do you remember that sort of decision making? That working FA was part of your career journey. I'm just curious.
It's a really good question that actually. It's a bit of a strange one because whilst I was refereeing, I was also doing a 25-year career with BT. I probably spent more time refereeing than I did working for BT, looking back in hindsight. But they were a very understanding employer and very supportive. And listen, I was very lucky because I left school with nothing at 16, and I was offered two jobs on the same day. One was with Lloyds Bank and one was with Post Office Telephones. And for some bizarre reason, which I don't even know to this day, I chose Post Office Telephones. Again, a really lucky but good call for me because I worked through the privatisation of what was Post Office Telephones to BT, and I ended up being one of the youngest members in the first ever BT sales force and benefited from a lot of excellent sales training at the BT Management School, where many of the facets of that training have been the cornerstone of my career as well, in credit to them, in terms of managing people relationships, and all the things that go with it. What fast forward to 2000, then an opportunity arose at the Hampshire FA. They were looking for a new secretary stroke chief executive, and I didn't actually it got sent to me. I didn't even know it was being advertised, and out of the blue, I got a someone said, you ought to be looking at this. And I thought, well, it's a bit of a change. I'm quite fortunate. I had quite a senior role at BT in those days, and certainly the salaries were not commensurate in any way at all. But I ended up applying for it. Amazing interview process. I got interviewed by the whole board of 13 directors. Never had an interview in front of 13 people before. And somehow managed to get through to the second interview, which was even more bizarre, because I had to have lunch with the other candidate, the directors, before they interviewed us individually, which was all a bit strange. But and I ended up getting the role, and so I swapped the fast moving world of BT, which it was in those days and still is, I think. I remember on my first day, I walked into Hampshire FA, and I honestly thought I walked into a Dickensian scene. And as the retiring secretary was sat behind a desk with two piles of paper that almost hit the ceiling, and he peered over the top of them. So I entered the world of football administration, and it was quite an exciting time because my appointment at Hampshire FA was about the same time, or just after Adam Crozier had been appointed as chief executive of the FA, and Adam really started the modernisation of the FA, if you like. That was the start of the modernisation process, and so I sort of I suppose having come from a commercial world, a bit like Adam, I sort of applied the same sort of approach to Hampshire FA, and it hit me then that all of a sudden I'm sort of leading the Hampshire FA, learning from the most wonderful chairman I've worked with in the world, John Ward, who was chair of the, God rest his soul, was chair of the Hampshire FA at the time, and a wily, wise old man who taught me an awful lot about football politics. And I started a modernisation programme. I've gone into this organisation. It was probably operating then as it probably was back in the 50s, to be truthful to it, a young workforce. And It obviously working in a county FA as a CEO, and for the first time, it was about the time that the FA started to drop some funded posts into county FAs. So the relationship with the FA and the county, prior to that, the relationship between county and FAs and FAs was quite, they were quite independent in many respects. That started the journey as to where we are today. And I found myself on this career line that all of a sudden I'm in a county FA and I'm modernizing it and I'm having more and more involvement with the FA. And listen, I even as a referee, my passion for the FA was huge. You know, if I got one disappointment in my life, probably was that I never got awarded an FA badge as a referee. You know, that meant a lot and didn't happen for a good reason. So wanting to work for the FA, yeah, was always high on my agenda. Why wouldn't I want to work for, you know, what in my opinion is one of the, you know, world's governing bodies in football? So, you know, why wouldn't, you know, I think you'd aspire to work for the top organisation in any industry you want to. I had a great team at the Hampshire FA, and the current chief executive, in fact, you know, he worked with me, and I mean, I was delighted to see how he was a young man in those days, and he's really grown, and he's, you know, he's now chief executive of the Hampshire FA, and he's done a brilliant job there. And you know, it was, again though, you're driving, it was a change management program. You were driving change management. And that was complex because you were dealing with members who didn't like change, really pushed back against it. You had to modernizing the committee structure. It was modernizing how the organization presented itself, how it dealt with the outside world, because it never dealt with the outside world.
Yeah. Is that do
And
you
so
mean
it was,
outside world from a commercial standpoint? Is that what you mean?
from a commercial point of view, from a media point of view, it didn't have any real relationships. To the level that I thought it should have done as a large county FA. Its relationships with its pro clubs were very, very loose. I worked hard to build those and develop them. And ironically, that's how, in the end, I ended up spending a couple of years at AFC Bournemouth as chief executive.
Can we dig deep here, Lawrence, on the importance of relationship building in the football industry? I know you've just given a hint that there wasn't any; they're very loose. Why is it important to have that relationship building process, not just with the governing body, but also with clubs and the whole ecosystem?
Listen, I work on a basis in life that I always like to have relationships and surround myself with people to support what we're doing. And, you know, football is a competitive world. At the level of the game I work at, where, you know, it is competitive, there's no doubt about that, certainly on the green stuff. But there's a lot of work that and a lot of experiences that should be shared. If we're looking to make football increasingly more sustainable, if we're looking to reposition what the role of clubs is or are in the community, then we all can learn from each other. You know, and you know, and you know, there and there is a lot of sharing in football as well. Whilst it's competitive on the pitch, a lot of clubs do share. They want to share, they want to learn. You know, I have a lot of calls with people about not just what about the FA, but what happens at Harbour Town? What works for us? What doesn't work for us? And a lot of clubs do that, and we should embellish that and welcome it. You know, it's brilliant. That's how the game will survive and grow. You know, it's important. And the FA, you know, the FA's got its club program now, which is designed to support that, to help clubs, because clubs are faced with a lot of challenges. Remember, clubs are going from that environment where they were solely a football club into a business. Now, a lot of the clubs are businesses. They need to have, you know, no different to any other business. You need to have your commercial arm. You need to have your strategic relationships. You need to be able to, you know, pick up the phone and talk to different partners to help develop what your offer is. And so we're actually, because the world's changing, clubs are going, I've had a call today with a club where, you know, who about this very subject. How do we transition from the club we were to where what the world wants football clubs to be today? Because the most overarching thing is every football club wants to be self-sustaining. It's really important. You know, we have you're never going to remove, I don't think, the vulnerability and fragility of football, of sport. It happens in every sports club. They are fragile, vulnerable environments. But the more we can double down on that and make them more sustainable by building those relationships, it's really key. So for me, building relationships has been always really, really important. You know, it's also about raising the awareness of all the good things that happen. If you don't tell a story and tell people what you're doing, how are they going to know? Yeah. We should always look inwardly. If we're only getting 50 people through the turnstile, or we've only got 100 people playing football, what are we doing wrong? Why haven't we got 200 playing football and 100 playing and coming through the turnstiles? What can we do better as an organization to make people aware of what our offer is? I think with the football product we have got in this country now, it's something we should be, all of us, everybody involved with the game, actually should be really proud of. You know, I see some of the work done by clubs, both at the professional level and outside of the professional game in the National League system and our grassroots clubs, is phenomenal. And most of it is done by people giving their time freely. That's an incredible gift, you know. And it's something we should be really precious about and very proud to promote. Driving change, like, and the change that football's gone through. I mean, we said earlier on, didn't we, that if you look where I started out my journey back in the late 60s to where football is today, there is no comparison. That's not solely being driven by a desire in football, that's being driven by the world that we live in. You know, and one of the biggest things in that is social media. The visibility that everything that happens in the world today has on social media. You know, back when I started my journey, if there'd been an earthquake in Japan, I would not have known for 24 hours. Now I know the second it's happening.
And just on that point, how important is storytelling now using social media to relate to some of the points of clubs transitioning into like the new way a club should be in the game? The importance of storytelling as a method.
Listen, social media is an incredibly positive tool when used wisely. Unfortunately, there's a flip side to social media, isn't there? We all know that. And social media can be incredibly damaging. And that's a shame, because as a positive tool, it's fantastic. You know, and you know, you can, and it's really noticeable. I think in the last 5 years, if you look at the National League system, the coverage of the National League system on social media is significantly higher today than it was 5 years ago. You know, clubs, and what it's actually doing is making clubs far more streetwise about promoting what they're doing, promoting their matches, promoting what their offer is, promoting their facility. Actually, probably as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, that wasn't happening. So social media in that context is raising awareness of what's happening in the game.
And building community as well online.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, building communities. And inevitably, because you're building communities, there is going to be an element of that you don't like or you don't want or whatever. And, you know, I suppose the wise approach is don't take everything you read at face value. Pick out the bits that you are interested in work for you, you know? And I think, and I think so. I think it's really important to, but social media as a tool, I think, actually has grown the awareness of the level of football that I'm involved with, the National League system, significantly, actually. And then that brings, hopefully, lots of positive benefits to the wider game.
Exactly. And I want to talk about today's podcast topic because we've already discussed it, everybody. But for me, when I met Lawrence in person at a BL Ballers event run by Berrily, great job. And it's really due to Berrily we're doing this podcast. A shout out to BL Ballers. Lawrence said a really key phrase that hit home to me during the event was like, football is a reflection of our society. And that is today's podcast topic because you've been in the game for a long time, but also we've touched on it, some of those themes already. But just to hit home this point, how is football being a reflection of our society, not just from a national standpoint, but global standpoint as well, Lawrence?
Football has always been a mirror of our society. It reflects, and You have to look at where football started and its journey. Football was very much a working class sport. That's where it started. You go back to, the late 1800s. That's where there were primarily two disciplines of sport. And actually, football didn't change very much for the next 80 odd years, probably. But what we've seen. When I reflect back and see where football is today to when I started my journey, as I said earlier on, that there is no comparison. If I think of what football looked like in the 60s, male-dominated sport, a very autocratic, perhaps bureaucratic decision-making administrative process sat behind it. And let's be honest, predominantly white male playing football. If I look at football in 2023, 24, it the change it, it's a global phenomenon, isn't it? The game is now has open access. It will never ever be enough, possibly. I don't know, but the game is the constituents of the game are very different to the constituents when I started my journey. There's been, the work that supports making football accessible for all social groups, irrespective of religion, gender, culture, ethnicity, is huge. And it's absolutely making a difference. Others will always judge whether the difference is enough, but it will be because it reflects our society. Our society has changed out of all recognition in my lifetime. And I think what we're seeing in football today is real success in that. There's always more that can be done. And we all own that. It's easy to say this organization or that governing body should be doing this, that, and the other, but we all own it, There has always been, I think the one of the, I think the biggest challenge in the big one of the biggest challenges facing our society and in turn facing football is behavior of people. And I don't think we should hide away from it. There's far too much unacceptable behavior in society. There is far too much unacceptable behavior in football. I always think I always work on the basis that one unacceptable incident in football is one too many. But I also think we've got to be very careful not to spin a too negative view when we look at the total number of football matches being played and the number of incidents there are. So you've got to have a little bit of a balance in there. But behaviour in football is a big challenge, and we shouldn't shy away from it, as is behaviour in our society.
I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate here. Sorry to interrupt, but I think it's important. With behaviour, that's an uncontrollable. And that the only way that, let's say, fan behaviour, as an example, let's say being racist to a player on the pitch, because that's still going on right now. And then it has that knock-on effect on social media. I don't know if you've heard, Lawrence, but there's a new app called Striver, which Gilberto Silva built now, where it's a social media platform which has zero abuse on it. And you can interact with players. And for me, I did this at Athens where we dig deep of this problem, and it's still a problem. Let's say Harry Maguire is like another example, maybe not race, but it's certainly on a pitch with the fans influencing him if he's not playing a game. So I see you nodding your head, but from an FA standpoint or an administration standpoint, you can't control my behavior on that except with punishment. And I'm just trying to share that. The reason I'm bringing this up, and we're going a bit deeper, but I think it's important. How do you find that balancing act where, with people's behavior, you can't control a human's actions, except what I've just said on punishment, when they get caught and there's proof of their behavior that's been bad?
There's a couple of approaches. One is, listen, there is no place for unacceptable behaviour, and the punishments have to reflect that. That's a start point. I think there's a point for that, and that's about education and putting things in place that help people educate and understand. We, you, you know, well, you know, the amount of football played in this country over a course of a weekend. Regrettably, there is going to be one or two instances. It's inevitable, isn't it? So there has to be strong punishments. Now, punishments will always be a subjective view as to what is strong and what isn't, and you know that is not an argument I would open up. But there has to be that there is no place in football for antisocial, racist behaviour. That's my personal view. I absolutely abhor such behaviours. There is no place for it. There is no need for it. And the trouble is, and we could spend quite a lot of time going into the depths of what the root causes are. You see someone be, and unfortunately, there is social media doesn't help either, because you can go on social media any time of a weekend, and at some point you'll find a clip of a group of fans fighting or a group of fans being abusive, whatever. So clubs absolutely do their best to control it within the means that are available to them, as does, and the FA and the county FAs have the regulations in place to deal with participants. Do I think there's an easy fix? No, because it is a societal problem. It doesn't just happen in football, it happens across all walks of life. It is absolutely unacceptable in all walks of life, but for the focus of this conversation, it is totally unacceptable, and there is no place in football for such behaviours. And we all of us in the game have responsibility to deal with it. It's not just one group. Everybody who is involved with the game has a responsibility to stop these appalling behaviours. And I feel really strongly about that. Because football is called the beautiful game. Some of the things in football are not beautiful. Let's be honest about it. We are trying to create an environment that is positive. Positive experience for all sorts of different people and different backgrounds that our society today is in this country. And for people to go into those environments and behave in a manner, whatever that behavior is, whether it can be an angry parent, football, a supporter of a club, whoever it is, a player, a coach, referee, who does not want to adhere to what the sport is about.
And just on that point then, on collaboration we mentioned earlier, how important is collaboration to amplify the education? So for example, I hope this podcast is a tool for education of what we've discussed now, because that was a really powerful conversation we've just had. But I just want to hit home about it's not just the club's responsibility. There's ways of collaborating where it's a support system.
Ed, we all own it. We all own it in society. It's about individuals having their own, setting themselves their own personal standards as to what is acceptable. And there's a clear line as to what is not acceptable. And we can all go into the causes of it, but the point is, football is always going to be a victim of wider societal behaviours because of the sheer volume of people that are involved in football. So it's not something football can solely solve on its own. This is a wider societal issue that we should not be afraid to stand up and say, yeah, the behaviours we see in some in yeah, some of the behaviours we see are just not acceptable. We shouldn't have a place for them in our society. And there is certainly no place for them in football.
Because this is the opposite of what football for all is all about. The point you've just made then.
Of course it is. Football's got to, listen, football has to be an outlet for a positive environment, positive experience in a great environment, irrespective of age, ability, ethnicity, gender. We want football to be a positive environment. You're talking to somebody who's had the most wonderful time in football. I've had a ball, absolute ball, coin a pun, and it's you know, and I see all and listen, there's been some dark moments in that journey as well. Of course there has. There is in every journey. This sport is amazing. And we should absolutely embrace it and use it wisely to make our society a better place.
Look, Lawrence, I hope people are taking notes because I think what we've just discussed, I'm so grateful that we had it in our conversation just now. Because for me, I've always want this podcast to be more than just a careers journey. It's still looking at the positives or like anything, the good, the bad, the ugly, with one of my puns, because I think it's really important to highlight where the game has grown from a football industry standpoint. Lawrence, out of interest, though, you've just given me a little hint. You've had a ball, but reflecting, what have you enjoyed the most from your career journey in the football industry, looking back right now?
You know, it's really difficult to pull out a simple answer to that. Because I've enjoyed every experience I've had in my football journey, to be truthful. I mean, my refereeing career was just, for me, was just, I just loved every minute of it. You know, it was a great time in my life, and you know, and I really enjoyed the games, irrespective whether it was on the local park or whether it was walking out in front of 30,000 people in a large stadium. I got a huge buzz from that. It was just, you know, but I was young and I was fit, and you know, it was a great time in my life. I've loved my journey in football administration because, I think one of the things I've really learned is it. You never know everything. Every week, every day, something comes up. You think, oh. Or, and it's not about something necessarily practical. It's more about how you manage something, how you handle something. You're never too old to actually learn new tricks, and you're presented with new equipment. So, and in this environment, which is a really people-led environment, it's good. I think, look, as a football fan, the highlight, unadmittedly, as a what would have been a probably a someone in their late 50s, I cried the night Bournemouth got promoted to the Premier League. I mean, having had followed, had had the halcyon days of following Bournemouth around what was Division Four grounds on a rickety old coach back in the late 70s. So someone say AFC Bournemouth would be in the Premier League one day would be a would be amazed. I was equally proud though when Harborough Town got promoted to Step Four. I have to say that I'd sort of fallen in love with this this football club in Market Harborough for some bizarre reason, but I have. I think the best thing in my journey in football is has been the friendships and the people I've met. I have to be really honest. I've got so many friends and acquaintances who each in their own way have always been supportive and been encouraging. And I think that's important as when you're on a career. You know, I've got my close group of confidants who I trust implicitly. Who I go to when I need help, and I think that's important for anybody starting out on a career. Make sure you make sure you've got a close group of confidants that you can go to, and you can trust, and you can ask get their advice on difficult situations. I think I'm one of the luckiest people on the planet, if I'm honest. I think it's really nice. I've been at. I mean, this is Bob. This year is going to be my what am I, 65? So this is going to be my 49th, 50th year at work. 49th year at work this year. I can honestly say I've enjoyed every year, despite even some dark spots. And I think to be able to say that after 49 years at work and still feel energized and passionate and not ready to retire and want to do all the things I want to do and still want to drive change, I think that's a great place to be at six, but we'll be 65 in a few months' time.
Love it. Love that answer. And you're spot on about having meaningful relationships and having that inner circle. That's the term I use when I share people pursuing a career. Having that inner circle you truly trust is vital. As always, Lawrence, I'd like to finish with an inspirational question. And feel free to recap of some of the things you said already in this conversation. But for people listening in after taking action of after listening to this podcast, what three tips would you give them with regards to pursuing a career in the football industry? What three tips would you give?
Never give up. It took me four attempts to get into the FA. So never give up. Never lose confidence in your own ability. And make sure you have a group of trusted advisors.
Yeah, I like that. I hope people attain it. I'm going to ask one cheeky last question because you just give me a hint. Those four attempts, how did you cope with the rejection to keep being resilient, to still working, to get the role you wanted?
Mixed bag, really. Most of them were fine. One I was very disappointed about and shook myself down and said, right, made me more determined, actually, if I'm very truthful. This is a competitive world. And one of the challenges in the football industry, and I don't think football's alone, I think it's a challenge in a lot of industries, is that there are a lot of flat structures. And we live in a world today where quite reasonably young people, because I was the same, well, I was young once upon a time, are ambitious. And it's about being patient and being the best you can be. Don't try and be something you're not. That's one of the things I've really learned in life is, you look around you and you see what other people do and how they do it. And it's quite interesting as you get to get to my age, my philosophy on life's changed in the sense that my role in life now is to support the young people coming through. I'm quite open about that. At 65, in terms of career progression, it would be fair to say it's probably only one door I'm going out of at the FA, if we're honest about it. So it's I'm quite honest about, I'm quite reflective about that. But what I'm very strong on, and I always have been, is that I'm very passionate as I've got older about sharing my knowledge and my experiences to help young people who are starting out on their journey. Because it is a journey. When you leave education, whenever that is, and you go into the workplace, that is the first, that's a big change in your life. And it's even harder for the generation who went through COVID because they lost some of the workplace experiences because they weren't in the workplace. They were very isolated. And that's quite a challenge as well. But I also think it's about recognizing, it's understanding the environment you're in, understanding the organization you work for. And only at the end of the day, all of us as human beings, we can only control what we can control ourselves. We can't control anything outside of that. And so the adage, be the best you can be in what you do and how you present yourself and how you appear to others and how you communicate to others. And don't lower your standards. I think that will always hold you in quite good stead.
I'm nodding my head, I agree. And Lawrence, on that point, how can people interact with you on social media? Like, where are the best places to go to learn from you?
Well, I openly admit I'm a dinosaur, Ed. Even doing a podcast is quite a challenge. Best place for me is LinkedIn.
Perfect. To all this is listening in, that LinkedIn link will be on my website with regards to this amazing podcast chat. Lawrence, I'm grateful for your time and thank you for being a special guest on the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
What a spectacular podcast chat with Lawrence. Honestly, it's conversations like this that light me up for many reasons. Number one, I think it's a great reminder when you learn from people who are wiser than you. And for me, it was lovely with regards to understanding Lawrence's career journey and how football has changed in the men's and women's game to where the game is today from a society standpoint. And then with regards to today's podcast topic, I really enjoyed that current theme of change and why change is healthy, but how we communicate change as a leader was a fascinating component of this conversation. Something that I know I'll re-listen to with regards to me being a better leader, with regards to the sports industry or football industry. Or even this podcast, where we use change for the greater good and we look at change as a way that we have to adapt with regards to the modern world we live in right now. And I think for that, I'm really grateful for Lawrence, for that conversations we had. And some of them were really important conversations of that, as much as, let's say, from an FA standpoint, they are always trying to thrive and grow and make it a safe environment. There is still more work to be done on and off the pitch. And I think for me, it was wonderful to hear the reality check of Lawrence saying it was like a totally different world, how football clubs were run, in the 70s and 80s, and how things were done from a stadium standpoint to where the game is now with the stadiums we experience. They're just a, t it's, you can't really compare, but it, It's just that reality check that there has been growth. We're just so used to that environment, what we're living in now in football, we just take it for granted and we don't take a step back and reflect the change, certainly with regards to English football. But with regards to a sports career standpoint, it was right at the end, which is really important, is controlling the controllables with regards to our standards. And that will really influence our behaviour and our attitude in the football industry or any industry in that matter when you're showing the best version of yourself. So really put that into action with regards to your sports career development. But right now, you must have got some takeaways from this podcast chat, which you can apply straight away after listening to this. So write it down and then start putting it into action now and take action. Now, as always, at the end of each podcast episode, I'd like to finish with an inspirational quote from my guest speaker. Lawrence said, "Never give up. Never lose confidence in your ability and make sure you have a group of trusted advisors who can support you."